locked down, and both Agnelli and I knew it. Privates Chen and Baker and Specialist Sanchez were all veterans of Nigeria, and Sanchez had served briefly in Korea before that. Greg Chen was an ABC from suburban Maryland. He had to explain that ABC meant American-born Chinese, since I had no idea what he meant. Jerron Baker was raised on a farm in Alabama, which he was immensely proud of, and he was immensely grateful to get away from. And Pete Sanchez was from eastern Kansas. His parents had a small farm, but his mother worked as a nurse and his father at a car dealership, their farm not being big enough to provide a living for a family. Their previous sergeant was now a staff sergeant, leading a squad in 2nd Brigade. We got off to a great start when none of them made a Barney joke, or asked about or seemed in any way curious about what I'd done the first time I saw a Ruhar. They'd read all about it. It was ancient history, and it didn't mean squat now. The four of us got to know each other in drills and combat exercises over the next week. I was collapsing in bed each night completely exhausted, and I hadn't been happier in a long time. I had a great team, and we were honing ourselves for battle with an enemy that had threatened our home planet. What we needed was a real mission. 8 days after my promotion to sergeant, our brigade received orders to deploy. I'd been scrambling to get up to speed for the next war game, Operation Razor, in 10 days. We got the news from Captain Teller, who assembled the company in an empty hangar on the edge of the base. He stood on a platform at the far end, with us crowding forward to hear him.
"People, we have an opportunity."
Chen groaned and whispered, "Bohica, man." "Bend over, here it comes again," was a popular saying in the Army, especially when an officer said we had an opportunity. It usually meant we were getting screwed one way or another, hence the time-honored expression. Teller waited a moment for the inevitable murmuring to die down.
"We have an opportunity to put our new toys into action and do something useful in this war. UNEF received orders. We move out in 2 days and a wake-up. 1st Brigade is going in with one British and one French battalion. UNEF is all in on this one. Everybody's going. The whole force is bugging out over the next 2 weeks."
A guy in the front spoke up. "What's the mission, Captain? We gonna kick some rodent ass?" The question was asked with deadly seriousness. Teller made a face like he just bit into a lemon.
"Nope. The Kristang say we're not ready for that. I've seen Kristang battle simulations, and they're right. We're not ready. We just get in the way. Most combat happens in orbit, or further out, and since we don't have a space navy, we can't help there. The Kristang have retaken a colony world they lost to the Ruhar a while back. They're kicking the Ruhar off the planet. They've reached a truce. The deal allows the Ruhar to evacuate their civilian population over a 13-month period. It will take 13 months because there are almost 1 million Ruhar there now. Our job is to occupy the planet and facilitate the evacuation."
This news did not please the company.
"Garrison duty?
Shit, we're gonna be peacekeepers.
You have to wear freaking blue helmets?"
Teller had his hands in the air until we quieted down.
"I came out here to fight the Ruhar just like you, to kill those rat-faced MFers. I don't get to do whatever I want. I'm in the Army. Our job out here is to protect Earth, and since we sure as hell demonstrated we can't do that by ourselves, the best way for us to protect the folks back home is to work with our allies. The Kristang are stretched pretty thin right now. They don't have many troops to spare to hold the places they've captured. That's why they asked for infantry. There's some sort of biological hazard on this planet that prevents the Kristang from landing in force right away. The Kristang say the Ruhar are cheating on rule number 4. The Ruhar say the virus or whatever is left behind from back when the Kristang occupied the planet. That's for them to argue about. Bottom line is the Kristang can't land their troops on this planet unless they're wearing full environment suits, and that ain't happening. Until the Kristang can develop an antidote to the virus and distribute it in quantity, UNEF is going to be fully in charge on the ground. This is a job we can do, and we're going to do it to the best of our ability. Those are our orders."
"What's the ROE, sir?"
A loud voice from the back asked about the rules of engagement.
"No shooting unless they shoot first. Whether we like them or not, the Ruhar on this planet are mostly farmers, and that includes women and children. The Kristang tell us not to expect much opposition. The Ruhar Civi should be happy to be alive and allowed to go home.
There was a lot of grumbling from Able Company. Tella didn't flinch.
This is a test, in case you haven't figured that out yet. So far, all the Kristang have seen from humans is us dying, without inflicting much damage on the Ruhar.
He paused, frowned, and continued.
In WW2,
he pronounced the words precisely,
the U.S. Army didn't hit the Normandy beaches in their first battle. We landed in North Africa first, and those of you who know your history know that's a damned good thing. We were completely unready to take on the Germans in 1942. If we'd landed in Normandy first, we would have gotten our asses kicked back across the channel. By fighting in North Africa and Sicily and Italy, we learned how to fight the Germans, learned what worked. The Kristang have given us a few shiny new toys to fight with. That doesn't mean we know the best tactics to use them against the Ruhar in ground combat. The Kristang have trusted us with what should be a simple job. We cannot screw this up. We take control of the planet, we move the Ruhar civvies to the space elevators and get their furry butts off the planet, and we secure the place until the Kristang sort things out upstairs and can land their own troops. We are going to show the Kristang that the United Nations Expeditionary Forces are disciplined, competent, and ready to take on combat operations in the future. Platoon leaders, I want your squads ready for departure inspection at 1400 hours the day after tomorrow. Are there any more questions? I spoke up.
Sir, where are we going and what can we expect for conditions? I wanted to know as much as possible about what my new fire team would be getting into.
The short answer is we're going to bumfuck Neptune.
A smile only lifted one side of his mouth.
Oxygen-nitrogen atmosphere. A bit more oxygen than we're used to. Gravity was 2% heavier than Earth. The star is hotter than our sun, but the planet is further away, so the climate is similar to Earth. Hot at the equator, ice caps at the poles. It's mostly a farming colony. The Ruhar call the place Gitanu, which translates roughly as new grain field or something like that.
That drew a chuckle from the crowd.
The Kristang call it Pradasis. We're calling it Paradise. It's got one big-ass continent, a couple island chains, and big islands like Greenland size. The rest is ocean. Our PowerPoint rangers put together a briefing deck which your platoon leaders should have on tablets to distribute. It says the main continent is largely flat grasslands, like the U.S. Great Plains or the Russian steppes. Lots of big farms tended partly by robots, with the Ruhar clustered in villages. All the intel we have will be available on your notepad shortly. I need everyone to study up during the flight. The whole 10th Division, plus our British and French friends, will be loading on 3 transport ships, and the trip will take 16 days. After we drop, the Kristang will keep a destroyer plus 2 frigates in orbit for fire support, but this is our show. General Mears has assured the Kristang that we can handle this. We are not going to prove him wrong.
Shauna pinged me before I could contact her.
You hear? We're moving out.
Yeah, we're going to paradise.
Paradise,
she laughed. We hadn't been together since my promotion to sergeant. We'd both been too busy, and I was way too tired. It hit me then that I might never see her again once we left our base on Camp Alpha. We'd probably be on different transport ships, then assigned to different sites scattered across the surface of paradise. Hey, good luck on qualifying for infantry. I didn't want the call to end, and I didn't know what to say.
Thanks. That'll have to wait until we get there.
There were loud voices in the background.
Joe, I have to go. Let's keep in touch.
Sure. And that was it. At least we'd be on the same planet. You might think that 2 days and a wake-up means we had 2 full days plus a luxurious full night of sleep before we had to assemble for departure. You'd be wrong. The wake-up happened at zero dark stupid, It felt like my head had barely hit the pillow before lights snapped on in the tent and my feet had to hit the dirt. Getting up at Zero Dark 30 was nothing new to me, and I didn't resent it, even though I was not by nature a morning person, or even a mid-morning person. And my sister was an annoyingly cheerful morning person, and growing up I'd wanted to smother her with a pillow more than once. Anyway, I had to get up at Zero Dark Stupid, which meant I then had to wake up my fire team. The difference between Zero Dark 30 and Zero Dark Stupid is that Zero Dark Stupid means you rouse out of bed, get all your gear ready, and assemble for departure inspection, only to stand around for 3 goddamn hours when you could have used those 3 hours for something productive like sleeping. As a sergeant now, I had to endure the resentful glares from my team while keeping a neutral expression on my face. The whole departure was a clusterfuck. The Kristang wanted their dropships loaded as quickly and efficiently as possible, which meant cramming the maximum number of people aboard in a frantic rush, even if that meant splitting up platoons, squads, or even fire teams. When we finally boarded a dropship, Baker and Chen had their feet in the door when the MP held out a hand to stop anyone else from boarding. "We're full, move on to the next ship," she announced. I frantically yanked Baker and Chen back out by hauling on their packs and waved another 2 guys forward. Hell, no way I was going to let my new fire team get split up right after we'd met. You'd think we would be the first in line to board the next dropship, but the MPs keeping us organized had other ideas, and several dropships lifted off before we were waved forward. Being aboard a dropship wasn't the last of the confusion. When our dropship docked and we got aboard the Kristang starship, we discovered we were not only aboard a different ship from the rest of our platoon, but most of the ship was occupied by the U.S. Army 3rd Infantry Division, not our home unit, the 10th. The ship had people from the 3rd, the 10th, most of a company of U.S. Marines, more than a full company of Chinese, 2 squads of Brits, and a scattering of Indian troops. Either the Kristang didn't understand the concept of combat loading, or they had so little regard for human combat capabilities that they figured it didn't matter whether our units were scattered all over hell and gone. Supposedly, UNEFHQ was keeping track of who was there, but I had no way to contact anyone in my chain of command. I got us to bunk with some other people from the 10th. It was a lonely voyage, and I was grateful that my guys shrugged and took it in stride. If this was the worst screw-up we got into, we'd be doing great. Chapter 4. Paradise. Unlike Alpha, Paradise had a space elevator. It looked a bit different from the one that hovered over Earth. Someone told me this one was put there by the Ruhar. That surprised me. I figured the Ruhar elevator would have taken a hit during the battle when the Kristang had retaken the planet. Maybe targeting space elevators was against one of the unwritten rules. Or maybe it was just practical. The people trying to conquer a planet wouldn't want to damage a valuable asset, and the defenders figured even if they lost that battle, they could try taking the planet back again someday. The Ruha elevator rode a lightning bolt like the one on Earth did, but whereas the Theranin elevator cable was pure energy, the Ruha design had a physical cable, thinner than a human hair, in the center of the lightning bolt. Because of this, the Ruha didn't have any vital facilities on the equator of Paradise. If that cable ever snapped, it could wrap itself around the planet several times and crash down with a considerable impact, despite the small mass. We were told the cable had explosive charges along its length to make it less of a disaster if the cable ever snapped or was cut. But for sure, I didn't want to get stationed on the equator. I'd spend half my time looking warily at the sky. The trip down the elevator to Paradise wasn't much different from the trip up from Earth, except there was no smiling army cook serving delicious cheeseburgers. We had to settle for MREs again. And this elevator car had more windows, and the passenger compartment was easily 3 times the size of the one at Earth. I guess this one was designed primarily for civilian use. We got a good look at Paradise as we descended, and we descended pretty fast. There was a lot more vibration than I remember on my one other space elevator experience. Paradise looked good. At least it had a lot of green and blue, not the star-blasted dead browns and tans of Alpha. As the elevator car got close enough so I could see the outlines of villages, it occurred to me that I would soon be setting foot on my 3rd planet, and this would be my 1st planet that was enemy territory, even if that enemy had already surrendered to the Kristang. Getting low enough so individual buildings were distinctive, I touched the new sergeant's stripes on my sleeves. This place was a home of my enemy, the aliens who had attacked Earth. Not that I needed any extra motivation, but at that moment, I was filled with determination to do everything I could to get the Ruha off this planet on schedule and show our saviors, the Kristang, that humans could be entrusted with more important tasks in the future. And if any damned hamsters got in my way, well, I'd remember the rules of engagement, but I wasn't taking any crap from the hamsters. I would show them the same courtesy they showed us when they sneak-attacked Earth and destroyed much of our electric generation capability. When the elevator car landed with a gentle thump, we were hustled off as quickly as we could move. It wasn't 10 minutes after the last of us cleared the fence line around the elevator complex that a series of alarm blasts rang out, and the car ascended again to pick up the next group in orbit. I watched it, craning my neck, still amazed, as the guards hurried us along to an airstrip where there was a line of the biggest airplanes I'd ever seen. The guards called them Dumbos because of their large body and relatively small wings. They had four engines, buried inside the wings near the roots, and they were probably 6 times the size of the U.S. Air Force C-17s I'd gotten used to. Dumbos needed only a short runway, but they couldn't take off straight up. That took too much power to be practical in a heavy lifter. While I was watching, one lined up and took off, its engine screaming, and I swear the thing was airborne in less than 400 yards. The engine exhaust could pivot down to help get it off the ground, then the wings took over to provide lift. Anything that big, moving that slowly through the air, made me think there must be an invisible string holding it up. Like buzzards, Dumbos were leftover Ruhar equipment that we humans were expected to use, until the Kristang took over. We were supposed to assemble by platoon, except my fire team was alone. I managed to keep my fire team together. It wasn't difficult. And after a while, I learned where we were supposed to go to eventually link up with our platoon. Once staff sergeants counted noses in squads, then platoons, and then at the company level, we waited. And waited. And waited some more, in the hot sun. We must have waited for an hour, as other platoons and companies marched past us onto Dumbos, and as Dumbos landed, loaded, and took off again. I could see chickens and buzzards circling the airfield in the distance. They were already a familiar sight from Alpha. The blessing was whatever material the tarmac was made from was a light tan color and didn't bake in the heat the way dark-colored asphalt would have on Earth. After an hour, with my fire team being on their best behavior for their new sergeant, we finally marched halfway across the airfield, past a couple empty waiting Dumbos, to our Dumbo. It was good to see the U.S. Army was just as awesomely efficient and organized on other planets as it was on Earth. We all crammed together on uncomfortable seats made of lightweight netting and sat down to wait again. There was cool air blasting out of vents in the front of the cabin. By the time the air got to us in the back, it was as hot and humid like the air outside. Some kind of commotion was going on at the back ramp, with the captain pointing at a tablet and arguing with a lieutenant. The lieutenant shook his head at the captain and walked toward us, clearly unhappy. He got close enough for me to read Koenig on his name tag, and I stood up and saluted. "What's going on, sir?" "Charlie Foxtrot," he muttered. "Another typical clusterfuck. They say we're on the wrong bird. We'll get it sorted out." Whatever the problem was, 5 minutes later the doors slammed closed and we started rolling. Everyone cheered. The word got passed down that we should relax and get settled in for a 2-hour supersonic flight. The pilot made an announcement when we settled into cruise speed, which was around Mach 1.4. Even having traveled faster than light, going through wormholes and going down from and back up to orbit in a shuttle, that speed impressed me. Then it hit me that the announcement was a human voice. I leaned over to a second lieutenant sitting next to me. "Sir, who's flying this thing?" He yawned.
"Some Air Force pukes."
How much flight training did they get?" I asked slowly, not wanting to hear the answer I expected. On Earth, C-17 drivers had years of training before they qualified for even the right-hand co-pilot seat. No way could these guys have more than a couple weeks flying time in a totally unfamiliar, gigantic aircraft.
"Nothing to worry about, Sergeant," he said,
although I noted he wasn't looking at me when he said it.
"There's a computer that does most of the flying, and a Kristang in orbit can take over and land this thing remotely if needed.
The guys up front are there to make coffee.
I didn't laugh. The flight was uneventful, except it ended in a landing so abrupt it made me think the pilot was Navy, not Air Force, and he was trying to land our Dumbo on an aircraft carrier. Then I saw the airfield, which was a dirt field, a field that had contained some sort of crops recently, before the land was cleared for airplanes. Without much waiting around, we were marched across the field to a rank of waiting buzzards. I was excited, eager for a ride in the unfamiliar aircraft. 30 of us crammed into a buzzard. I wanted to sit in the doorway, legs hanging out into the air, rifle on my lap as the buzzard roared low across the landscape. The co-pilot quickly straightened me out.
This bird isn't a Black Hawk, Sergeant. We cruise around 400 miles an hour when we get to altitude. If you want to hang out the door, go ahead, but shut it behind you.
I found a seat. A staff sergeant was grinning at me, but he later told me he'd been thinking of doing the same thing. The flight in the Buzzard was also uneventful, much smoother than any helicopter I'd flown in, and we flew across endless farmland and scattered forests and lakes until we circled a village and sat down. When the door of the Buzzard popped open, we smelled it. You know the scent of new-mown hay? Or if you lived in the suburbs, freshly cut grass, that clean, fresh, invigorating scent, a scent of nature that reminds you of childhood, of running barefoot across a field under bright blue heavens with big, puffy white clouds piled high in the sky. Yeah? This was not like that. The scent wafting from the hamster's field of whatever the hell they ate smelled vaguely of... Baker sniffed and wrinkled his nose.
Pam. What is that?
It wasn't right there in your face. It was more something at the back of your mind or the back of your nose. A scent that makes you stop and try to identify it. I had a good memory for scents, but it took me a moment to figure it out because it was close, but not quite right. Parmesan cheese, I announced. Not Parmesan cheese as in a big hot bowl of spaghetti on a cold winter night with a couple juicy meatballs on top, and you've been smelling that tantalizing tomato sauce simmering on the stove all day, and you're sitting down with a slice of garlic bread and a glass of hearty red wine, and you sprinkle fresh Parmesan on top, and it kind of melts into the sauce? Not that. This was Parmesan cheese as in you're already sick with, like, the flu or just an epic hangover. And your stomach is already on the edge, and you smell Parmesan cheese that's been out of the fridge too long, and you know you're going to hurl. That's the Parmesan cheese we smelled, coming from the fields. Parmesan? God damn, it smells like Sanchez's feet, Chen said disgustedly. My feet? You ever smell your own? I wash my feet. Once a year, maybe. All right, pipe down, you two, I ordered. Maybe it's a chemical they spray on the crops and it'll go away. Or we'll get used to it and not even notice it anymore. Shit, Chan spat. I've been bunking with Sanchez for weeks and I ain't got used to his stinky feet yet. If this whole planet smells like that, this is gonna be a long deployment. The rest of our platoon was already there. They'd set up a base in tents around a barn. The hamster town was half a kilometer to the east. I got my fire team sorted out, and the first sergeant of the platoon told me to report to Lieutenant Charles in a tent. I saluted smartly. Sergeant Bishop, reporting as ordered, sir.
Bishop, I expected your team this morning.
He gave me a casual salute back. He seemed to be distracted. Establishing a platoon base on an alien planet had to give a guy headaches. Charlie Foxtrot loading the dropships at Alpha, sir. The Kristang put us on the wrong starship. We're all here now, sir. Sergeant Agnelli is getting us squared away.
Yeah, UNEF is scattered all over this planet. Now you made it here. That's what matters.
He pointed to a map laid out on a table. A real map, printed on some sort of plastic. It showed about a tenth of the main continent, the part where we were right then. It was mostly farmland, flat farmland, with some low ridges running north-south, rivers and lakes here and there. The seacoast was off to the west. The space elevator base station somewhere off the map to the southeast.
We're here in this region.
He circled a finger around a gray shaded area.
The Ruha call it some damn thing.
He pointed to the markings, which were in Ruha script.
But we're calling it Butt-Scratchistan.
Butt-Scratchistan, I laughed. He smiled.
The region to the north of us is Backscratchistan, so to the south here must be Buttscratch, right? Your fire team will occupy a village about 100 kilometers west of here.
He pointed to a tiny dot on the map.
The hamsters there are all farmers. Population about 250 if you count the surrounding farmsteads. There's a school, barns, a grain storage building, some houses, and that's about it.
One fire team of 4 soldiers against over 200 hamsters? I didn't like those odds. A fire team didn't usually operate alone. 2 fire teams belonged to a squad with a staff sergeant in charge.
So how is one fire team supposed to keep control of that many hamsters? You're not. This is an experiment, he grimaced. A bright idea from division. We have company-sized quick-reaction teams scattered around with buzzards and chickens, backed up by Krestang firepower in orbit.
He glanced at the ceiling of the tent.
There's plenty of firepower available if we need it. What Division wants is to avoid needing it.
My shoulders slumped. Hearts and minds? That was the Army term for attempts to get the civilian population to cooperate with us, or at least not actively resist us. It had started in Vietnam, and continued in various forms and terminology in Iraq, Afghanistan, Nigeria, and pretty much every place the U.S. of A. had gotten involved. We built schools, roads, water and power distribution systems, and helped plant and harvest crops. Long term, it was cheaper and more effective to avoid making more enemies than it was to kill enemies. Especially since the enemy you killed was someone's relative, and they, and probably their entire tribe, then became your enemy. If you know anything about history, you know these kinds of hearts and minds campaigns have, let's say, a mixed record. A month after we pulled out of a third world area, the schools got burned out, the water system blown up, and the power lines stolen for scrap copper. Our politicians declared victory anyway and moved on to the next crisis. Hoo-ah!
More like soft power, Bishop. We're not going to build schools for these hamsters. We just want to keep things peaceful until they take the trip off-world. Think of it as your own little slice of paradise, he added with a grin.
Sir, I'm a new buck sergeant.
Hey, you're also a farmer. You grew up on a farm. Sanchez and Baker did, too. These aliens may be hamsters, but they work the land. I'm hoping that gives you an understanding that some of our city boys won't have. This region is in the middle of the line to be evac'd off-world, so there's more time for things to go wrong.
He put a hand on my shoulder and squeezed reassuringly.
You don't have to be nice to these hamsters, but don't try to intimidate them. They've already agreed to leave the planet. The deal they have with the Krestang allows them to continue raising and harvesting crops right up until the evac is complete. The Ruhar are paying the Krestang to transport their crops, I know. It sounds crazy. But the Krestang have been fighting this war for a long time, and they know what they're doing. The Ruhar here want to keep those food shipments flowing. They should be well motivated to cooperate with us. If you get into trouble, whistle us on your Z-phone, and we'll bring in the air cavalry. If it gets bad enough, the Krestang can hit any site you want from orbit, and the hamsters know it.
Again, I wasn't filled with confidence.
Agnelli will be taking the other half of the squad to a village north of where you'll be. You're not an occupation force. UNEF is calling these units embedded observation teams. G2 wants to know what's going on with the hamsters at the local level. All the satellite and airborne surveillance in the galaxy won't tell us what's really happening on the ground, and a recon team passing through once in a while won't tell us enough. We need people on the ground, living among the hamsters. There's a complete set of guides for EOTs on your tablet. It would be best to get you some training, but Division wants everyone in place ASAP to establish a presence before the hamsters get any stupid ideas that UNEF can be pushed around.
Yes, sir. We've got this. I didn't have to like it. That's why they are called orders and not suggestions. When I got to the area the platoon was using as a motor pool, my confidence dropped even lower. What in the hell is this thing? I asked. It's a Ham-V, Sergeant, the grinning mechanic announced. A what? We call it a Ham-V. It's like the old Humvee on Earth, only it's leftover hamster vehicles. We take any type of hamster truck, glue composite panels on for hillbilly armor, and you get a Ham-V.
He looked proud of the piece of crap he expected us to patrol around in.
Barney's ice cream truck looked more capable. If you took an SUV, added big but flimsy-looking tires, thick screens over the windows and multicolor panels attached haphazardly here and there, you'd have something almost as ugly.
Glue?
Yep. Can't weld it on because it's not metal. We use this Cristang glue. He held up a caulking gun like you'd find at any hardware store on Earth. Apply the panels to the ham V with this dingus, then use this fancy Cristang doodad. It looked like an iron. To set the glue. Incredibly strong stuff.
Dingus. Doodad.
You're not impressing me. He shrugged. And the Cristang have names for all this stuff, but it's hard to pronounce.
Is there anything heavier? I asked, as I skeptically ran my fingers over the farmer armor panel, which felt like styrofoam to me. It was about 4 inches thick, tapering down at the edges of the doors, which had to be a weak point, if styrofoam had a strong point anywhere.
We have ham tracks, kind of like a Bradley or a Striker, because it has wheels. They're hamster military personnel carriers. And those are for company-level use. Don't worry. I've seen a demo of this armor. He wrapped the styrofoam with his knuckles. And regular bullets only dent the surface. You have to hit it in the same place a couple times with an explosive round to punch through. Tough stuff. We should bring some of this shit back to Earth with us.
A demo? Are you joining us on patrol the first time we get shot at?
He shook his head and grinned. Not my MOS, Sergeant. Hey, you guys have fun, and don't scratch the paint. Private Ringgold here will show you how to drive them and keep the power cells charged.
After we picked up our pair of ham Vs, we went over to the supply depot to get all the equipment we would need for our EOT assignment. The supply depot was in what looked like, and smelled like, a former chicken coop. First, we got personal gear. Extra uniforms, body armor, all the crap a well-dressed human soldier occupying an alien planet needs. Next, ammo and heavy weapons, which meant Javelin Bravo missiles, and our old familiar light unguided anti-tank weapon, the 84mm Swedish AT-4CS. Here we are, on an alien planet, badass conquerors, and we're equipped with weapons I'd used against militia nutcases in Nigeria. This was unsat, in my opinion. Nobody asked for my opinion. The next morning, we were ready to depart. First Sergeant Mitchell came to see us off.
Is squared away, Bishop?
If I said this was November golf, which was no-go in Army slang, would it make any difference? Mitchell laughed.
The LT wouldn't send you out if he didn't have total confidence in you, Bishop. So Alpha Mike Foxtrot to you.
Adios, motherfucker, is what he meant. I didn't reply. We rolled toward our assigned village, trailing a cloud of dust that drifted high in the breeze, giving away our position to anyone who cared to look. As we approached the village, we came to a low rise, and I called a halt to our column. Column was an exaggeration. We had two ham Vs, me and Sanchez in front in a sort of SUV thing, and Baker and Chen behind in a pickup truck. Both vehicles were loaded with gear, including what the platoon thought was enough consumables, meaning everything from food and medicine to toilet paper, to sustain 4 men for a month. We also had a standard load of rifle ammo, both regular and explosive-tipped, plus 2 Javelin Bravos and a pair of AT-4s. No mortars. If we needed any sort of standoff weapon, we were supposed to call the air cav. The first sergeant assured me we'd get regular visits from the platoon HQ and supplies every 2 weeks. If this first sergeant was as skeptical about this soft power concept as I was, he kept his feelings to himself. Personally, I gave this experiment less than a month before Division or UNEFHQ came to their senses. Having part of our forces thinly scattered across the planet was inviting the hamsters to defeat us in detail, which means each small unit could be overwhelmed piecemeal. If that happened, the hamsters would eventually get pounded from orbit by the Cristang, but that would be of little comfort to any dead humans. As prearranged, a pair of chickens flying overwatch buzzed the village low and fast to get the attention of the resident hamsters. The chickens had their weapons pods open, and after they buzzed the main street, they broke formation and climbed, with one providing cover to the north and one hovering over us. I glanced one more at the intel package on my lap. Satellite photos, reports from a recon column that had passed through the village 2 days before, and records from the Hamster Regional Government. According to their records, the current population was 178 hamsters, down from the estimate of 250 I'd gotten from the platoon.
Our arrival should have been no surprise, as the Hampstead government said they'd contacted the villagers to alert them to our approach and to urge cooperation. We also had plastic laminated signboards printed in Ruhar script that we were supposed to post in prominent locations around the village. The signs supposedly listed regulations like curfew hours, prohibitions against carrying weapons, and what the hamsters were to do in order to accommodate us. The idea of putting up posters made me uncomfortable. It felt vaguely like some heavy-handed thing the Nazis or Soviets would do when they occupied a village. I signaled the chicken pilot we were ready and told Sanchez to get rolling. Our badass ham V's cruised into the village on nearly silent electric motors, tires crunching on dirt and gravel, slowing down as we reached the first building, the official start of the village. The village wasn't much to look at. Although being from a small rural town myself, I appreciated that the buildings, both houses and barns, were neat and in good order. Houses had shade trees, shrubs and flowers, fences and barns were well kept. I'd have expected the hamsters to let things slip, forget about maintenance and things like planting flowers, since they were all going to be evacuating the planet. I expected graffiti like, "Humans go home," or something like that. Instead, I saw signs the hamsters were planning to be here for a while, including a barn that was in the process of having the roof replaced. Were the Ruha unable to accept that they'd lost the planet, or did they know something UNEF didn't know? Either way, it was going into my first sit-rep back to Platoon HQ. Sanchez was from eastern Kansas. He remarked that the village, the fields, and the countryside reminded him of home. It reminded me of my small-town home, too. The houses were neat, but not fancy. Each house had a barn or workshop behind it. Back home, such houses would have a sign out front advertising the hundreds of side jobs rural people did to make ends meet. Honest work like selling fresh eggs, welding, small engine repair, haircutting, log splitting, child care. My father thought you could combine tasks like log splitting and child care. No more lazy kids sitting around with coloring books or playing with Legos. My father would say, "You kids better have those 3 cords of wood split and stacked by 5 o'clock, or no juice boxes for you. And no crying if you hit your foot with the maul. Walk it off. It's just a flesh wound." I may be exaggerating a bit. There were vehicles in the road or fields, and even though they were clearly alien, they also reminded me of home. Every vehicle had a dented fender or a body panel that was a different color. These were working vehicles for working people. My kind of people. Except they were aliens and they had attacked Earth without provocation. Now that I thought about it, I hope neither of our two ham V's had been commandeered from this particular village. That would make for an awkward situation. A male hamster walked partly into the street ahead of us and waved, in what I hoped was a friendly or at least non-threatening manner. I could tell he was male because the fur on his face was a light downy coat all over. Females had facial fur almost too fine to see. Also, males had bigger whiskers. He was wearing overalls, blue denim-type bib overalls with patches on the knees, an outfit identical to several my father wore for working around the house, and a straw sort of baseball cap with a wide brim. The hat had a logo. Was it a hamster sports team or a seed business? Maybe the logo of the company that made the tractors in the fields. I called a halt, got out, and told Sanchez to stay put with the engine running. My rifle was on the seat. I had my sidearm, but otherwise was unarmed. Hearts and minds, I told myself. Hearts and minds. See if we can start things off peacefully. I could get rough later if needed, but a rough start was hard to overcome. Besides, the pair of chickens, weapon pods bristling, were hovering in plain sight, ready for action. My Z-phone was already set for Ruhar. I held up one hand and said simply, "Hello." The hamster spoke into his own sort of Z-phone-type device.
"Hello. Welcome to Teskor. Teskor is our village."
So the name of the place was Teskor, or that's what the translation sounded like. We hadn't been able to read the Ruhar script on the map. I pointed to my chest. "I am Joe Bishop. My rank I left out, not sure if sergeant would be meaningful to aliens." The hamster nodded.
"I am called Lester Cornhut."
"Lester Cornhut?" I asked, surprised. I swear to God that's what the translator said in my ear. We've been told that names were not translated, so the sound of Teskor and Lester Cornhut came through just the way he said them in the slightly squeaky Ruha voice. The hamster said, "Yes," and smiled. Baker asked me on the tactical channel,
"Did he just say his name is Lester Cornhut or Cornhole?"
"Cornhut," I replied, with the translator function paused. "There's a T sound on the end of it." The four of us got a good chuckle and agreed that Cornhut, an excellent name for a hamster farmer. I turned the translator back on. "You are the leader of this village? The leader of Teskor?"
"No leader. No government here."
He pointed from one end of the village to the other. I guess he meant the place that small didn't need any form of government.
"I was chosen to speak with you. We will cooperate as instructed by..."
My translator made the humming sound it did when it didn't understand something.
"And we hope your time in Teskor is pleasant. This is a good place."
Enemy species or not, Lester hadn't personally attacked Earth. May not have ever heard of our home planet. Hearts and minds, I told myself. We had a brief discussion, confirming he understood the date the people of Teskor would leave for the trip to the space elevator, and that we would be commandeering a farmstead on the outskirts of town. Lester told me they had already cleaned the place in preparation for our arrival. The family who had lived there lost a son when the Kristang took the planet back and had moved away months ago to live with relatives. We put up our posters, drove to the other end of town and back, and drove out to our makeshift command post. All in all, our entrance to the village was anticlimactic. After we got to the house where we'd be staying, I waved the chickens off, and we started unpacking our Humvees. I felt like we were children playing house. I sent a message to Shauna, but it didn't connect. Possibly she hadn't landed yet. That first night I couldn't sleep much. I was too pumped up about my first command, even if it was only leading an experienced fireteam on a recon mission. Setting up our command post, I felt like a real sergeant, a leader. I took the first watch and let the guy sleep. And toward the morning, I got up as sleep was elusive, and relieved Baker so he could get a bit more shut-eye. In addition to being excited, I was nervous. If the hamsters were going to do anything hostile, they were likely to do it our first night before we got fully settled in with surveillance systems and ranged fields of fire around the CP. To keep watch, we had set up a ladder so we could climb up onto the roof of the house. That's where I was early that morning. The roof had the advantage of an excellent 360-degree view. It had the disadvantage that the person keeping watch was totally exposed to sniper fire. Our Z-phones had a nifty feature, that if the person the Z-phone was assigned to died, as in their heart stopped, the Z-phone would alert anyone nearby. Which gave me the great comfort, as I sat exposed on the roof, that if a sniper picked me off, my fire team wouldn't be taken by surprise. UNEF thought embedded observation teams of a four-man fire team off by themselves in the middle of nowhere were a great idea. Sitting on the exposed rooftop in the wee hours of the morning, I was not so sure we weren't simply sitting ducks. In the early morning, when a person's thoughts can match the enveloping darkness, I wondered whether UNEF was hoping vulnerable EOTs would be attacked as an excuse to show the Kristang what humans could do in combat. Lord knows the U.S. Army had sent me out on patrols in Nigeria that seemed to have no point other than exposing us to IEDs and sniper fire. It wasn't the Army family that I didn't trust. It was the politicians giving orders. Folks back home would be more excited hearing about humans in combat than hearing about UNEF performing garrison duties that didn't generate headlines. Politicians certainly loved headlines. Still, it was peaceful in Teskor. So peaceful, so quiet. Sitting up there on top of the roof, peaceful and dark. With the planet so sparsely settled, there wasn't a lot of light pollution. Teskor seemed pretty dark at night, with no streetlights, and only a single dim light here and there at the front or back of the houses. I hadn't experienced darkness like this since I left electricity-starved northern Maine. Our base at Camp Alpha had been lit by floodlights at night, blanking out much of the sky. Here, sitting on a rooftop in the tiny village of Teskor on the alien planet of Paradise, I saw the sky, the stars, the Milky Way. This far from Earth, the constellations were all wrong, but, man, the Milky Way was sweeping across the sky in all its glory. It was mesmerizing. I had to remind myself not to stare at it, that I was up on the roof to keep watch, not to gaze at the stars. I swept the horizon and the road from the village with an infrared scope. It was all clear. The eastern sky had just the faintest hint of pink from the approaching dawn, and insects began to buzz or chirp or whatever insects did on this planet. This time of morning is when on Earth birds would begin to sing, but Paradise didn't have any native birds. The guidebook said the biosphere wouldn't evolve flying animals other than insects for many millions of years, and since the planet was now occupied by aliens, Paradise probably never would get a chance to evolve birds on its own. I sat on the roof, watching the eastern sky lighten, listening to the low buzzing of unseen insects, and felt homesick. I missed Earth. Mostly I missed the Earth that used to be, before alien invaders, before electricity was a luxury, before we saw twinkling lights in the sky and thought of anything other than meteor showers, before Columbus Day. While we were eating breakfast, I got messages from Cornpone and Shauna. Cornpone told me our old squad was part of a rapid reaction force base about 500 miles north of Teskor. He sounded excited. It was a damned good assignment. Way better, he said mockingly, than babysitting hamsters. I had to agree with him. The fire team had replaced me with a guy from North Carolina, and Cornpone said the new guy was a huge improvement over me since the new guy had a proper southern accent instead of my down east drawl. Shauna reported that her unit was temporarily at a logistics staging base almost 1,000 miles to the east. I wrote 3 messages to her, erased them, then sent a simple note. The odds were that we wouldn't see each other for a long time, maybe never. I tried to respond in a way that was friendly but not too friendly, so she wouldn't feel she needed to make any special effort to keep in touch, because then it would just get awkward. By the 3rd day of us patrolling the village, we were all starting to feel more than a bit foolish. For a patrol, we would put on full battle rattle, our Z-phone earpieces, cameras and microphones, tinted goggles, and march down the streets, rifles ready, a finger poised near the safety, trying to look tough as we walked past neat little houses and barns, well-tended fields and the school, all the way out to the edge of the village, then turned around and walked back. It was not easy to look tough as hamsters sat on their front porches in the morning sipping tea and waving to us, or working in the fields and barns and pausing to wave to us as we walked by. Or the hamster children waving excitedly, eager to see the strange new aliens. Us. To show the hamsters that our fire team had serious backup, once or twice a day that first week, a couple buzzards and chickens flew over at low altitude, circled the village, and resumed heading west. The gesture was supposed to give my unit confidence also, but after we watched the aircraft disappear over the western horizon, it only reminded us how isolated we were. The turning point of our EOT engagement in Teskor came on the morning of the 7th day after we'd done our night and morning patrols, and I dutifully sent a report about nothing up to our platoon leader. I took Sanchez with me to check out a barn I was curious about. I wasn't suspicious about any funky hamster activity, just curious to see the inside of a hamster barn. As we walked past the school, a group of hamster kids were in the yard kicking a ball that looked like it was made from the hamster equivalent of duct tape. We knew the hamsters weren't getting any new luxury shipped in from off-world. The Kristang allowed only basic medical supplies to make the trip down from orbit. Everything else that was hamster-related was supposed to be going up to orbit one way. The kids probably had a soccer ball that went flat, and they tried to fix it with duct tape. The barn wasn't anything special. It was built from metal girders and some kind of extruded plastic sheets the Ruhar used everywhere. The exterior color was red, which I thought was interesting. Maybe painting barns red was another almost universal idea between alien species. At first I thought the barn was a type of chicken coop, until my eyes adjusted to the dim light. Then it got weird. There were animals being raised there, on racks along the sides, and it smelled like a chicken coop or a hog farm. The weird thing was each animal, about 2 meters long and 1 meter across, had a silver cap where its head should be, and there were wires and tubes leading into the wall in front of each animal. The animals rested in cradles. I noticed some of the animals further away were smaller, perhaps younger. What was truly weird was the silence. No clucking of chickens or grunting of pigs, only the whirring of fans and electric pumps. and there was my new buddy Lester Cornhut trotting up to me from the far end of the barn with a friendly wave.
"Greeting, Joseph Bishop," he called out.
"Greetings, Lester Cornhut." I must have pronounced his name correctly because he smiled and gave me a short bow. "What is this place?" I asked. "What are those?" I pointed to the strange, whatever they were. "Animals."
"Animals? Ah, these are not animals. Ruhar do not eat animals. We have long considered that to be..."
Lester paused to choose his words carefully.
"Barbaric."
He gave an apologetic smile. I wondered if what he'd said in Ruhar had been even worse than the translated word I heard.
"They sure look like animals to me," Sanchez said behind me. "They're moving."
Mr. Cornhut walked close to an animal, or whatever it was, and poked it. The thing didn't respond. Yet it moved periodically, rocking from side to side.
"These food sources," that probably didn't translate well, "do not have brains, and only a limited nervous system. Their bodies are almost all meat, genetically designed that way. A central computer," he pointed to the silver cap in the wires, "acts as their nervous system, which is why they move in a programmed pattern, to stimulate muscle growth."
"Huh. Damn, that's cool." Sanchez was impressed. "They grow only the meat, not the whole animal." I didn't know whether to be impressed or creeped out. These things were mindless. It was like raising a steak rather than the cow. It was eerie. It made perfect sense, it was efficient, and still it bothered me. Maybe I just wasn't ready for the future. This future. After we got back to the base, I asked Baker to dig through our supplies and see if we had a soccer ball. I thought I'd seen one in the recreational package the platoon gave us before they sent us off to live in bumfuck Neptune. During the next morning patrol, I tucked the soccer ball under my arm, and as we walked past the school again, I tossed the ball underhand to the hamster kids. At first they were startled and backed away from it, but on our way back I saw kids kicking it around and they waved to us. That evening, Lester Cornhut came to visit and asked for me. Sho Bishop is how he pronounced my name, which was probably closer to my real name than Lester Cornhut was to his real name. I mean, what are the odds, right? Through the translator, he asked whether I am the Sho Bishop who captured a Ruhar soldier during the military action on Earth, which he pronounced as Ert. Yes, I nodded. He smiled and paused his translator.
Ta.
He nodded his head up and down.
Nah.
He shook his head side to side.
Yes, I nodded.
No, I shook my head. Then I said, ta, and nodded up and down, and nah, and shook my head side to side. He did the same gestures for yes and no. That was our first true interspecies communication. If we weren't on Paradise only because the hamsters had attacked Earth, I would have been thrilled. Back to the translator. He told me the hamster regional governor would be visiting Tescor in 2 days, and she wanted to meet with me for tea. Seriously? Afternoon tea time with the enemy? And were we going to have little cucumber sandwiches and scones and crumpets, whatever the hell a crumpet is? Lester was okay for a Ruhar. He was a farmer, and likely had no involvement in attacking Earth, if he'd even heard of Earth before the humans arrived on Paradise. But a regional governor had to be part of the Ruhar government that had attacked Earth and killed humans. I felt like telling Lester that his bitch governor could shove her visit where the sun don't shine, and that I wasn't some circus sideshow curiosity for him to show off, step right up and see the human who captured a Ruhar soldier, we promise it won't bite, only $5 including a free souvenir. Hearts and minds, I told myself. Hearts and minds. If Division G2 wanted intel, a regional governor would know a lot more about the situation on Paradise than my buddy Lester, that was for sure. I would be honored to meet with your governor, I said, expecting that speaking through a fake smile wouldn't translate his sarcasm.
You bring tea for yourself. We have hot water. I think you do not drink our tea, no?
Lester asked. Oh, for crying out loud. They really expected me to drink tea with them? Eh, what the hell? One of our food packs must have a tea bag in it. Bringing it with me didn't mean I was going to get all cuddly and sing Kumbaya with the damned Ruhar. Chapter 5. Intel.
A couple days later, Lester Cornhut stopped me during morning patrol to tell me excitedly that the regional governor would be at his house promptly at 1600 hours. He tapped his wrist like he was wearing a watch. And could I please come to his humble abode? Sometimes the translator went overboard. I'm sure he hadn't actually said humble abode in Ruhar. I was tempted to make the hamsters cool their heels waiting for me, but my mother raised me to be polite, and the military had drummed into my head the habit of being promptly on time for everything. Promptly at 1600 local time, I arrived at the Cornhut residence to see the regional governor, Lester Cornhut, Mrs. Cornhut, and the little Cornhuts. Baker waited outside. Sanchez and Chen were at the CP with the heavy weapons just in case. My visit had been cleared, even encouraged, by Platoon HQ. For the visit, I left my rifle, helmet, body armor, and goggles back at the CP, bringing only my Z-phone and sidearm. The sidearm was there because I'd feel naked without it, and it would remind the hamsters and me that UNEF was an occupying force. Emphasis on force, if needed. Oh, and I had brought a teabag with me, and a packet of sugar, in case I needed it. Lester greeted me excitedly. My guess was the regional governor didn't visit a hick town like Tescor often. They probably got more tornadoes than governors coming through the place. There were only three Cornhuts in the family. Lester, his wife, and a son, who I recognized from the school.
"Thank you for the ball," the boy said in English, or that's what it sounded like.
I was truly impressed the furry little guy made the effort to memorize those words, so I said ta and gave a little bow. He smiled, then Lester shooed him away, and poured hot water into two cups on a sort of coffee table in front of the couch. He then bowed deeply and left, leaving me alone with the regional governor. She looked like any other female Ruhar, although it was clear she wasn't a farmer. She was wearing a blouse and long skirt of a material that looked like silk, and her earrings and necklace were elegant and expensive-looking, not that I had any idea how to tell one piece of jewelry from another. The governor was sitting on a dark green couch with a flowery throw rug on it. I sat in a chair at the end of the coffee table. I sure wasn't going to sit on the damn couch next to her. She slowly spooned what looked like loose tea leaves from a box on the table, put them into an egg-shaped thing with lots of holes in it and a thin chain, and gently set it in the teacup. My grandmother had an almost identical tea egg thing, whatever you call it. "I am Sergeant Joe Bishop," I said, and put my teabag into a cup. It was a lot less elegant than the way she'd made tea. That irritated me for some reason. I knew the reason she had made her tea so slowly, deliberately, was to give her time to study me. She seemed amused.
"I am the regional governor of Lescorta. My name is Baturna Logelia."
She paused to wait for the translator to catch up.
"Your people who occupy my hometown call me..."
She paused again.
"The Burgermeister."
Her eyes twinkled, clearly expecting me to be amused.
"I think that Burgermeister is easier to pronounce than my name. No?"
I was amused. "Ta. Whatever troops occupied her town must have been stationed in Germany at some point. A Burgermeister is sort of a mayor in Germany. I think so. I mean, the closest I ever was to being in Germany was sitting in a transport plane while it refueled on the runway at Rhein-Main Airfield." The Burgermeister gestured for me to take my microphone and earpiece off. I pointed to my mouth, then my ear. "I need this so we can talk to each other." To my surprise, she responded in very slow, careful, and squeaky English.
"Sergeant Joe Bishop, please leave that outside. You can use this."
In her hand was what looked like a Kristang Z-phone, but a bit smaller. She offered it to me with its own mic and earpiece.
"I will explain," she said slowly, as if she had memorized only a few phrases of English and found our words difficult to pronounce.
I hesitated, then nodded. Army regs said I wasn't supposed to be away from my Z-phone while on duty, but this was an opportunity to get my hands on Ruha technology and maybe gain some intel about the hamsters. It was why UNEF set up embedded observation teams in the first place. I walked outside, gave my Z-phone to Baker, came back in, and used the Ruha device.
"Thank you,"
the Burgermeister said in English, then put her own earpiece in and switched back to using her translator.
"It is comfortable."
Even the computer version of her voice had a squeaky tone to it.
I looked at the display of the device, expecting it to ask me to speak a couple pages of text so it could learn my particular speech pattern, but it displayed "Ready" in bold red letters.